WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latte from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Another day, another trillion. The Federal Reserve gave us yet another $1 trillion surprise yesterday, pumping 12 more zeros into the economy, about a third of it for long-term government debt. First time since the Kennedy years that the government did this, buying up so much of its own debt. It's the Federal Reserve buying from the Treasury Department. And if that confuses you, it confuses me too. The move sent the stock market and Treasury bonds up, but the dollar way down. Mortgage rates should go down too, and the government confused most ordinary Americans yet again about what it's all supposed to mean. So it's a good thing that economist Simon Johnson is back for the last of his weekly visits this month to help explain some of the dizzying developments in the fast-spinning world of money. So we'll talk about this new trillion-dollar infusion, why the U.S. and Europe can't agree on a global stimulus approach, and the rebranding of the word bonus. Simon Johnson teaches at MIT. He's a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. He writes the Baseline Scenario Money blog, which includes the financial crisis for beginners, and he was chief economist of the International Monetary Fund from 2004 to 2008. Hi, Simon. Thanks again for doing this. Welcome back to WNYC. Simon, can you hear me? I don't think Simon Johnson can hear me.
Nice to be with you.
Now I've got you. Okay. So talk about a monetary fund. Please explain what this latest trillion is all about, especially the government sort of buying its own bonds.
So the Federal Reserve has reached a point where they are very worried about the economy, obviously. They have already cut short-term interest rates, their usual policy tool, by as much as they can. They're essentially zero. And they've been scratching their heads wondering what else they can do. And their solution is to buy up longer-term government debt, and this is a way to push down those longer-term interest rates and, of course, to also put a lot more money into the economy. $1 trillion is a lot of extra money. So this is a further attempt to jumpstart or restart or turn the corner for the economy.
This makes Treasury bonds more expensive to buy, if I understand it correctly, but makes them offer lower interest rates or yields. Do I have that right?
Yes. The price of Treasury bonds and the yields move inversely. So as their price goes up, the yield goes down. That's a mechanical connection. So that basically they're increasing the demand. They're buying the Treasury bonds, and that pushes down the interest rate.
And why is that supposed to be a good thing? So many people are putting their savings in Treasuries now, at least for the moment, as the only safe investment, and the yields were already so low.
Well, you're quite right that it does, you know, no good deed goes unpunished, and it certainly is the case that if you're in long treasuries, the price of them is going up, but you're going to get less yield. What they're really trying to do, of course, is support credit in the economy. The view is that access to credit and the cost of credit is a problem. So, for example, if they could force down your mortgage rate and you could refinance, let's say they could get mortgage rates down to 4.5%, and you'd get then a lot of refinancing, and that would help many people. It would reduce foreclosures and have positive effects. People with their money in savings account would still be annoyed. It's true, but on net, that should help stimulate the economy.
And most of this money is actually more for the TALF, which is one of the toxic asset purchase plans that we talked about a couple of weeks ago. So they decided what? That it wasn't working or that it was working, so they want to pump another $700 billion into this?
I think they've decided that they don't know if it's working yet, and they don't want to wait until that becomes clear. They want to go full at it. And if you saw Mr. Bernanke's interview on 60 Minutes on Sunday, it's very clear that he's extremely focused on avoiding another Great Depression. And I think in his view is that these measures are necessary to really remove that terrible possibility.
And why does this make the dollar go down against other major currencies?
Well, because there's a lot more dollars out there now, and people are begin to worry about there being more inflation in the dollar. And as we said, interest rates are going to get pushed down. So all of these things are leading investors to shift out of dollars into euros or yen or a bunch of other currencies, actually. Dollars pretty much weakening across the board.
Is it different from just printing money? I mean, I'm still a little confused about the Federal Reserve, which is one branch of the government, buying treasuries, which technically come from another branch of the government, the Treasury Department. Is somebody really selling something and somebody really buying something here?
Yes, I mean, the Treasury, you can do it in a couple of ways. One is you could go out and buy the treasuries from the private sector. So they're holding treasuries before and after you're done, they're holding money instead of treasuries. The other thing you can do, given particularly that our government needs to place new treasuries, a lot of new treasury bills and bonds with the public to finance the ongoing and growing deficit, the Fed can just buy those directly from the treasury. So instead of you ending up with more treasuries held by the private sector, you end up with more money held by the private sector. So those are equivalent ways of doing the same thing. By the way, if this doesn't work, the Fed can go out and buy anything it wants with money. They could finance tax cuts by printing money. Ben Bernanke has mentioned that in the past. Or they could actually buy the junk in your basement or my basement, and that would also be a way of putting money into the economy. Not an ideal way. I mean, this is a very risky policy. In fact, you might even say it's the worst of all possible policies apart from the alternatives.
Yeah. A commenter on a webpage says that I mischaracterized the Federal Reserve by calling it a part of the government at all. Would you say that's true?
No, it's definitely part of the government. It's subject to congressional oversight. The chairman of the Federal Reserve is appointed every 4 years by the president, subject to reconfirmation by Congress. And all the members of the boards of governors of the Federal Reserve are also appointed by the president. It does have a lot of operational independence. It does have a scope for operating that is typically much more independent of congressional approval.
Is that why they're doing this? Because for all the contentious debate in Congress about the stimulus bill and about the budget and about the TARP, the Fed can just come out and say, poof, we're going to do another $1 trillion program, and Congress, and not to mention the public, doesn't get to debate it.
Yes. But you have to be careful with that. You're absolutely right that they can do more and they can do it on a bigger scale than can Treasury. But they have to be very careful that they don't create the perception of running around the intentions of Congress. If Congress gets cross with them, the scope of action for the Federal Reserve is determined by legislation, and the chairman of the Federal Reserve has to appear in front of congressional committees on a regular basis. They can make the Fed's life very awkward. So it's important, and Mr. Bernanke has been rather good at this, actually, saying that he has to go to Congress to get approval for certain very big actions, such as what they did back in September with the original October with the original TARP money. But nevertheless, the Fed has much more leeway for improvisation, even on a massive scale, as we're seeing today and yesterday.
Now, listeners, you can call in with some questions for economist Simon Johnson. And remember, this is an explainer segment, so don't call on this one to spout off. We have plenty of shows for that. Call in to help yourself and your fellow listeners understand the underlying facts and ideas to help you form better opinions. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692 for Simon Johnson from the Baseline Scenario blog and from Princeton, from the Peterson Institute and MIT. Is this all related to fear of China? At the G20 planning meeting last weekend, As you know, Chinese Prime Minister Wen Jiabao warned that he was worried about the safety of his treasury bond investments. And of course, China owns so much U.S. government debt that people fret that they could decide to sell and crash out the whole economy. Are these two things related, what Wen Jiabao said last weekend and this decision to float and buy up new treasury bonds?
Not really. The decision on the treasury bonds and the Fed action is very much about what's happening in our economy and the lack of alternatives. The Chinese statement last week was really not a great idea on their part. I mean, remember they hold about $2 trillion of assets in U.S. dollars, mostly we think treasury obligations and maybe some Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac bonds as well. If the dollar depreciates a lot, that's bad for them. It's not actually that bad for us. I mean, we might worry a little bit about the inflationary implications, but it would also make our exports more competitive. Generally, it would help us with regard to global growth. I don't quite know why, you know, China would want to threaten this. It's not a very credible threat, and it's not something, you know, if they want to take the money and go home, fine. If the dollar depreciates as a result, fine. It's their problem. If they start selling out dollars, or if people think they're selling out dollars, which I really don't think they are, but if that perception is created, then the dollar will fall further and they'll lose more money. So
because China,
I don't quite know what they're up to.
Right, because China's so dependent on exports to the United States, so it fears crashing out U.S. consumer demand, you're saying, more than it fears anything about treasury bills. But in your answer there, you seem to not be able to determine exactly how much U.S. debt China is buying. Is that not knowable?
Well, it's not knowable by me and you. We know at least the official amount of reserves that China has, and we think that they're held mostly in U.S. dollars. But the currency composition of many countries' reserves is a secret, and that's true for China also.
Ken in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with economist Simon Johnson. Hi, Ken.
Oh, hi. Brian, you've already addressed my question somewhat, but I was wondering if Mr. Johnson could go further into this question. What are the advantages and disadvantages of you know, the Fed's just, let's say, printing money on the one hand and going for, you know, a TARP phase two or something like that on the other through Congress?
Well, just going out and printing money without any limit would scare people a great deal. It would certainly scare me. We don't want them to do that at this stage, or probably at any stage. And so this policy of buying up treasuries and pushing down the long interest rates is, I think, quite a responsible way to get more money into the economy and to try and move things in the right direction. As for more money in a TARP-type structure, more bailout funds of some kind, you know, I do think that cleaning up the banking system properly would require that. I also think there is basically zero chance that you can get any money out of Congress at this point, given how angry they are and we all are about how the financial sector has behaved. I actually doubt whether President Obama will get the $750 billion that for this purpose that he put in his budget. I rather suspect that that will not survive the budgetary process because everyone is so angry, and because there's good reason for that anger.
Joe in Reading, you're on WNYC. Hi, Joe.
Hi. I wanted to know why mortgage rates haven't come down when it seems for so long that banks have been borrowing money for nearly 0%.
Well, mortgage rates, I guess the view you could take on this is, I mean, it's a very good question, and obviously banks who can borrow at zero and lend at six or 6.5 are making some good money. But I think there's a perception of risk in that market, and I think also there's a general contraction in credit. So a lot of mortgages used to be securitized, meaning that they were packaged into bundles and sold off either as a complete bundle or as these absolutely terrible collateralized debt obligations, which were various tranches of those securities. Now, that market is obviously pretty broken. The Fed is trying to support that market directly, as Brian mentioned earlier, but so far that's, you know, going okay, but not great. So the process of funding mortgages is essentially damaged, and part of what the Fed is trying to do is get that restarted without necessarily taking over mortgage lending for every single American household.
Now, also at that G20 meeting over the weekend, which is really a planning meeting for the actual G20, which is coming up in a couple of weeks, The U.S. and Europe had trouble agreeing on a global approach to stimulating the economy and saving the banking systems. My understanding is the U.S. wants a global approach. Europe is skeptical. Why would they each be on those sides of that question?
Well, the U.S. wants countries to have more fiscal stimulus, more budgetary spending or cut taxes around the world. And Secretary Geithner proposed that every country commit to do an extra 2% of GDP of that. The European perspective is they've already done some of that. They have stronger so-called automatic stabilizers in their budget, so that when the economy slows down, they pay more in unemployment insurance and health benefits and so on for laid-off workers than we do. And if you compare these things, you know, on an apples-to-apples basis, their fiscal stimulus is just as good as the United States. You know, in reality, I would say the Germans like austerity and don't want to do too much stimulus, and the other European countries actually have fairly weak budget positions. So compared to those countries, at least, we don't have a lot of debt, and we have more scope for a fiscal stimulus. So there's really quite a standoff over that issue.
I saw German Chancellor Angela Merkel referred to somewhere as the new European Herbert Hoover. You think that's an apt bit of name calling?
It's a little unfair to Herbert Hoover, probably, but I think it gets the right idea across.
Does this crisis fray the idea of a unified Europe, or even the idea of the euro, which is now 20 years old, if the economic interests of different euro countries are different from each other?
Yes, I think it hits directly at that European dream and threatens to undermine a lot of what they've achieved over the past 50 years. And just to sort of encapsulate that in a single thought, when asked at the very highest levels last weekend what will happen to weaker Eurozone member countries, so a country like Ireland or Greece that shares a currency with France and Germany, what will happen to those countries? What should happen to those countries? What do they need to do if they get into financial trouble? These top finance ministers, particularly, I believe, the Germans, were saying they have to go to the IMF. So that's their best idea. When, after 50 years of integration and mutual support and holding hands publicly, you know, the first signs of serious trouble, they send them packing to the IMF. Now, I used to work at the IMF, as you mentioned. I like the IMF. I think it does a good job. I would never recommend that a country go borrow from the IMF unless it has really no alternative. It is a difficult, painful experience, and many countries find that it sort of scars them emotionally for one or two generations. So for the Eurozone to think of doing that for its weakest members, to me, says that the whole European project is called into question.
Bala in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with economist Simon Johnson. Hello, Bala.
Yeah, hi, Brian. I'm saying the dollar to go down is a good thing for the business over here, because the people can able to come in this country and buy some stuff. It's going to be cheap for them to go sell back. And if you live here, probably it's not a good thing for you, but if you're outside from the United States, it's good for you to get dollar and come buy the stuff going to be cheap, and the dollars, because the dollar's going to be cheap either.
Right. So, Simon, do you agree with that analysis of who gains and who loses from this cheaper dollar, which the Fed seems to be encouraging?
Well, the basic simple answer is that the caller is right, that a dollar depreciation helps your exports. You'll get more tourists showing up in New York City, for example, because the U.S. is cheaper. But, you know, because I'm an economist, I have to say, on the other hand, you also need to worry a little bit that if the dollar depreciates too much and too fast, that will push up inflation. And if we have actual inflation, or if we start to expect much higher inflation, then guess what? Our interest rates will go up, because people who lend money want to be rewarded for that extra anticipated inflation. And if interest rates go up, then the costs on our mortgages, for example, don't go down, which is what we want, they go up. So you have to worry about too much depreciation or depreciation getting out of control. But on the whole, I'm supportive of this Fed move, and I don't mind if the dollar depreciates 5, 10, and another 10% on top of this would be fine to me, particularly because it would put pressure on the Eurozone, which is really quite hidebound, to have a more expansionary monetary policy itself. And otherwise, they'll lose a lot of exports.
Economist Simon Johnson is here for another few minutes in the last of his three weekly visits with us this month. to explain some of the underlying principles in all this dizzying economic news. He teaches at MIT. He's with the Peterson Institute for International Economics. And he's got a great economy blog, The Baseline Scenario, and that includes The Financial Crisis for Beginners, which has a lot of fundamentals there at baselinescenario.com. Simon, let's go to our current flavor of the month in economic news, or at least flavor of the week, which is corporate bonuses. AIG, of course, is in everyone's crosshairs over this, but it seems to me that the very idea of a bonus is being rebranded. It used to be extra money for a job especially well done. I'm going to give you a bonus. But now we hear the bonuses are in the contracts of these AIG executives. So what is a bonus in this context?
Well, I think they're being rebranded as retention payments, aren't they? So they claim that they need to guarantee the bonuses in order to make sure that people stay on. And of course, the really remarkable and totally implausible part of the argument is, because these people set up really bad deals, only they know how to undo them. So while we're closing the business down, we need to pay them massive amounts of money to get that job done. It doesn't make any sense, Brian. We have literally lost our collective grip on reality, or they lost their grip on reality, and we're paying for it.
With your global perspective, is this common at banks around the world?
Well, no. This kind of contract is extremely rare in any economic enterprise, and guaranteeing bonuses in banks seldom happens. It does, you know, it is the case that if somebody tries to hire away one or two key people and you don't want them to go right away, you may guarantee the bonus, and you could, for an absolutely essential few people, maybe there's five people in your entire organization, even an organization of thousands, who might be worth guaranteeing a cash amount to, that if they stay through a certain date. But the scale of these guarantees and the nature of them is, as far as I know, and I've talked to quite a lot of people about this, it's unprecedented.
And you mentioned that they're called retention bonuses now, intended to keep people from leaving the country. And yet, as the Wall Street Journal showed in a very striking graphic yesterday, a fair number of the people getting these retention bonuses at AIG have actually left the country. So why isn't there something in the contract, if it's a retention bonus, that they actually cannot leave?
Well, I think that my understanding of that reporting is that they had to stay at the company. I'm not sure about leaving the country. I think you meant company.
Company, I'm sorry.
They have to stay at the company until a certain date, let's say December 31st. And then if they stay, then the bonus is paid to them in February or March. That's actually fairly standard practice for bonus payments. They come after the end of the year. And so by the time the bonus payments come, you may have left the company, but you still qualify because you were in their employment at the critical date.
I guess I would just think that if they were really retention bonuses, then there could be a contract that stipulates that you have to work for 2 years once you get this bonus, or even maybe that it would be paid out gradually, but somehow that the retention would actually be the obligation of the employee beyond 2 or 3 months.
But certainly you could write a contract of that kind, and the idea, I think the broader idea that retaining these people because they're the only guys who can get the job done is just implausible and excessive.
Why do you think this has developed, though, as such a common practice? Because it isn't just AIG. We heard about the Wall Street bonuses going down 44% this year and that hurting New York City tax revenues. But are there some kind of corporate politics involved, do you think, such as looking like you're keeping the base salaries down or something like that?
Well, that's certainly part of it. They do get relatively low base salary, or at least low relative to their bonuses. I think the bigger problem, Brian, is that corporate governance in much of the financial sector, particularly big banks and other big financial institutions, is very weak. In other words, the shareholders have few rights, and the banks are run largely for the benefits of the insiders, the employees who are near the top of the totem pole. And this is how they take their money out, and somehow it's become acceptable. You can get this through boards of directors. In my opinion, the boards of directors have really need a lot more attention and serious scrutiny because they've completely been asleep at the wheel. But anyway, this is without question the culture of Wall Street, and there is a presumption among leading luminaries, such as Jamie Dimon, the head of J.P. Morgan, who gave a big speech on this last week, that, you know, we're back to business as usual. We're going to continue with the same sort of risk-taking, the same sort of structures and the same sort of bonus payments. And I think, you know, there's a implication there which is not entirely welcome, which is that the taxpayer will be footing the bill not just for this debacle, but for all the debacles to come when their risk-taking blows up in their faces. And again, well, unless we change something more fundamental, we'll find that they're too big to fail.
All right. Well, that is where we're going to leave it with Simon Johnson. Simon, thank you again. These three appearances have been really informative. I know you're busy, and we really appreciate your time.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
Simon Johnson teaches at MIT. He's a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. He writes the Baseline Scenario Money blog, which includes the financial crisis for beginners. And he was chief economist of the International Monetary Fund from 2004 to 2008. Brian Lehrer and WNYC, coming up in a minute, another money mystery. WNYC's Beth Fertig has been looking into where the money is coming from for this lobbying campaign to keep control of the New York City public schools in Mayor Bloomberg's hands. And it is a mystery. Stay tuned.